to episode 58 of Meenal's World. Thank you all for tuning in again this week, and thank you for all your love and messages for my previous episodes. As you can see, I'm having to record my intro and outro with Radhika today. I've had no choice. This week, I had the chance to speak to Gina Martin, who's an activist and campaigner, and she changed the law around upskirting a few years ago. But I wanted to use my time with Gina to learn a little bit more about her life before she became an activist and how she wants to use this platform to not just continue to create the change that she already has done, but to help others in their own fights and their own campaigns. If you're listening to this on iTunes, please do leave a review and share this with your friends and family. It would really help us if we can reach out to more people. You can find all of my previous episodes on my website, meenalviz.com, and you can also subscribe to my newsletter where I share everything I've learned that week with you all. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, here's Gina Martin. Welcome to the show, Gina. It's so nice to finally meet you.
Oh, it's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I remember when I was campaigning and I messaged you saying, would you please be so kind to share my campaign and everything that we did? And you responded very immediately. So I'm very grateful that, especially over the last couple of years, you've used your platform to echo other campaigns' voices as well. So thank you for all your support.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure. I know what it feels like when you're campaigning. You need to get stuff out there.
Do you think things are different to what it was when you started campaigning a few years ago, like social media?
I don't know whether it's that it's different or just that the way I would do it now would be maybe slightly different. You know, like I think obviously it's developed so much and social media develops so quickly over like a year, it's different. I'm different than I was when I was 24 and campaigning 25.
Yeah, you were very young at that time. I watched your TED talk a few days ago and you started off by saying, I'm the person who's lost 23 debit cards. Yeah, I'm still the same person who changed the law. And I remember feeling quite similar as well when I decided to take the government to court because I knew nothing about politics. I knew nothing about how anything worked. And you think that even being a doctor in the NHS, you'd understand the nuances of the system, but I really knew nothing. So it just made me wonder, Gina, what was it like for you growing up? Were you aware of what was happening around you and the injustices and inequalities that the world was facing? Or were you just quite happy with everything?
I don't think, well, I grew up in a small town in northwest England, in Cheshire, and my family, I would say, are like were working class, definitely. But like because of my dad's job, my dad's a drummer, he plays drums. And because he would get a job playing with someone, we would almost have access to like middle class experiences and circles through my dad's job. And my family are a long line of Scousers from Liverpool. So there's definitely a mindset, I think, that comes with being a Scouser, which is, you know, Liverpool is a very, very socialist, very politically and both geographically kind of on the edges of Britain and obviously everything under Thatcherism. And so there's like a very, we are Liverpoolians vibe about Scousers. And I do see that in my parents, although my parents aren't hugely political people. But growing up, it was really that I understood, but I had a very loving, warm, cuddly, northern, protected upbringing. And I don't think I was aware of what was happening in the world really until my 20s. I was definitely insulated from that. And it was only really until I got into my 20s and started campaigning, started like reading books and listening and moved to London and met loads of people. And that's when I started to see things more clearly.
What was it like in school as well, Gina? Were things quite comfortable? Were you surrounded by mainly people from the UK or did you see anybody else from a different like skin colour or background?
Oh my God, no. The village was like just a classic suburban English village where it was almost all white people. And this was the 90s and noughties. And no, it was almost all white. I think there would have been two or three non-white people in my school. I don't know if there was anyone of any other, well, there would have been obviously people of different genders, but we didn't know about it at the time because they didn't feel comfortable to express that. I don't think that, yeah, it was a very, very all white upbringing. It was a very sheltered upbringing. But in terms of, I think in terms of class, there was like a realization of class, although not, didn't have the language to express it when I was younger. Like, you know, the school I went to, especially the high school I went to, was, you know, a state school and not a huge lot of money in it. And, you know, the kind of careers that would be discussed or the things when you had your like aptitude conversations with teachers, it was like, I would be like, oh, I do this. And they, and you know, it was kind of an idea of like, well, you can't do that, but you can do this sort of thing. So you were kind of prepared for, I think, the world within the realms of your class, obviously, because schools are created within the class structure. So I think that was apparent, but I couldn't have told you that at the time in that language.
It's weird, isn't it, that as we grow up and as we experience more of the world, we start to understand what we went through as a child. I've started to realize that maybe now as well, because I've got a little baby and I can see the world through her eyes. And I'm like, well, when I was that young, I didn't know anything and I want to provide her with a different sort of upbringing. But I also feel like if we did have that realization at such a young age, we wouldn't have the emotional toolkit or the resources to sort of deal with it. I think it would just be too overwhelming.
100%. I do think there's, it's a complex conversation, I think, from my perspective as who I am in the world, because I really do believe that if kids are young enough to experience racism, then white kids should be young enough to learn, are young enough to learn about it. And I believe that across the board with lots of different social issues that we have. But I also just want to live in a world where kids are able to be kids and not have to deal with racism and not have to deal with sexism and not have to deal with class issues. Not like, I just want to live in that world, but we don't live in that world.
I don't know if we ever will, do you know? That's
ever will
thing.
No, I don't think so either.
So I was in the park the other day and we were in a very nice area of London and I was walking around with Radhika. She's just like 20 months, she's got no clue what's going on, and there were a couple of 3 or 4 year olds who was on the other side of the road and they were talking to each other, and one said to the other guy, he said, do you speak French? And I was just like, you're 3. I could see the other kid was so uncomfortable because obviously he didn't speak French, and he could see that if he said no, then he would seem less to the other guy. And I was like, you guys are 3 years old, like you should be rolling in the mud. You should not be talking about French.
Do you speak French? Amazing. I don't even speak French. I'm 30.
Yeah, I did have to go away, Gina, and think about my life choices and what languages I do know, considering these 3 year olds. Yeah. So. But Gina, what did you, you know, you mentioned that when you were younger, you were talking to your teachers about what you wanted to do when you grew up. And was there anything you did want to pursue? Anything that you had passion for?
I was always a creative kid. Oh gosh, bless me, I'm yawning. That's not good, is it? Let me start again.
I hope I haven't bored you already.
No, this is just because I don't get enough sleep because of work. I was always a creative kid and not a traditionally academic child. My sister was very academic, as in, you know, what we understand to be academic in the schooling system, understood and was good at naturally English and writing and science and just got the grades. And I just wasn't like that. Like, I had to work really hard to get the grades in those kind of traditional subjects that are kind of seen culturally as more important. And I wasn't as good at those, but I really loved like drama and product design and graphics and drawing and stuff. So I think I always knew I would do something creative, but I flip-flopped along a whole bunch of different things I wanted to do. I think, you know, I was always looking for like, I always felt the pressure very young of like, what was I going to be in the world? Like, what choices was I going to make? What roles was I going to take? Which when you look back, you're like, just enjoy your life. You were literally 12. but it wasn't, I think when I was a teenager, I knew what I wanted to do. And that was that I wanted to be in advertising. And that was because I used to watch TV ads and I used to get to the end of them and be like, oh, it would have been so much better if they left off that end joke, or like if they rewrote this, or could the end line have been this? And I just did that naturally quite a lot, because they were kind of self-contained pieces of creative work that were like 30 seconds long. And I could digest them easily as a young kid, and I could like see them as a whole within a couple of minutes and be like, that would have worked at the end or that wouldn't. And so my dad was like, you should do that then, go and do that. So I did that. I went and studied, you know, advertising and art direction and creative advertising at Leeds Uni. And then I went and worked in advertising for 6 years. And so I think I probably... that was kind of what I was always going to do from probably my teenagers' years. But I wanted to actually probably be an artist when I think about it. I just didn't think I would be able to make money doing that.
Well, you kind of do that now, don't you, through your...
Yeah, exactly. That's why it's such a joy to do that. Yeah,
it's almost come full circle, hasn't it? That's great, Gina. I think there's a lot of things that we want to do in our life that we always get there, but we always get there in such a roundabout way that we never expect to get there in that specific path. So you're doing it now, which is great.
Yeah, it's non-linear, but...
Yeah. Gina, I read somewhere, I think it was one of your Instagram posts that you posted a few weeks ago, I believe that you spent some time in Australia. What period of your life was that? Like, where does that fit in your timeline?
Yeah, so that's because in 2013, I met my partner, Geordie. We're still together now. He's my best friend in the whole world. We've been together for 10 years, almost. No, nine. That's line nine. And I met him in Budapest in a hostel. And we just... stuck together ever since and just got on so well and just loved each other. And he's from Western Australia. He's from south of Perth. So from when we got together, we were long distance for 2 years. So he was working in Greece and he was in Australia and I was in the UK. And for the first sort of 5 or 6 years of our relationship, maybe five, are the way of keeping our relationship going because we were from the other sides of the world was to like travel and see each other. So I used to spend all my money on like just going to Australia once a year just so I could like see his family and like see him and he could be at home and he's got two little sisters. And so I've gone to Australia on and off since 2013 and see that as like a secondary place for me because so much of what I just, so much of what I love about Geordie is probably down to how Australian he is. He's such an Aussie and he's got such an Australian outlook on life and he's really helped me have more of that outlook. And I just, yeah, I love his family and I just love that place. And I haven't been able to go because of COVID for like 2 years. I miss it so much.
What kind of outlook do Australians have, Gina?
I don't know, but I've many different outlooks, I assume. But of the Australians that I know, which are the rural Southwestern Australians that I've know, we haven't been west, I've been to big cities. There's just a very, goes through everyone I know that there's just a very like, take it day by day, like relaxed, laid back way of seeing the journey like of life. So it's like, you know, when I met Geordie, I had like a 5 to 10 year plan and I was super stressed. It was like living in London, like, oh, I've got to do, get this job. Yeah. And then I've got to go, and then I've got to get a promotion this year. And then I've got, oh my God. And Geordie was like, you can't control everything. Just enjoy the ride, man. Like just, you know, and that's really helped me. Like it's really, he's really good for me in that way. He actually has no foresight and I have all the foresight for both of us. So we balance each other out. But I think I almost think it's something to do with growing up. He's grown up outdoors most of the time and spent most of his formative years and formative experiences outdoors in nature in a lifestyle that was very slow paced and in an environment that's quite harsh. It's a harsh place to live. Like it's a hot place to live. He lives in the bush. Like he doesn't live, you know, he lives in, not in the bush, but rurally. And I think there's definitely a sense of like, the pace is so much slower that he is just a much slower person in that regard. And that makes me calm down a lot because I'm very fast.
I feel it's the same with Nishant and I as well. Nishant was born in London and I was born in Gibraltar. So I still remember. Yeah. So I still remember. I came into the NHS in 2018. I got my first job and I walked into work and I was the happiest doctor anybody's ever met, which meant that everybody hated me. Like, why is this doctor so happy? Like, you should be stressed. You should be worried about your first day on the job. Like, you know, you've got patients to see. You don't know how to work the system. Why are you so happy? So when I did my first few shifts, I went to see Nishant. And Nishant's like, Mila, what's wrong with you? Are you taking drugs or something? Or why are you so happy? And I said, well, like, it's great. Like, this is what I've always wanted to do. And now I'm finally doing it. And I realized that the people who were working alongside me came into the job with that mentality. Like, I have to be stressed. I have to work hard. I need to be up all night. I need to be preparing my patients. And they completely removed the fun of what it meant to be a doctor. And I see that a lot here in the UK, which is why as well, I think Nishant and I have a nice balance where I have that perspective to enjoy life a bit. But I really do wish that especially young children who are put under so much pressure to go through the schooling system to just succeed all the time, that sense and idea of enjoying life just doesn't seem to exist at all.
No, I don't think we have that. Well, in the culture that I exist and I know and I've grown up in, I don't think we have a great balance in that. I think you know, you go through institutions that tell you how to reach, get this grade or tick this box, or how to act and how to, I mean, we talk about this in gender equality stuff, about how like the schooling system, especially like when you're talking about sex education, this seems like a diversion, but it kind of is, but it makes sense. Like, you want to talk to kids about consent in school, but they're in an environment where they have to ask to take their jacket off every day, and they have to ask to go to the toilet, and they have to ask to do this, and everything's very, very controlled. And I think we grow up in those institutions and we are kind of socialized to capitalism is the thing and get the job and make the money, because we know survival, because people are living under really difficult situations. So we know money doesn't come easy and it's hard, and we live to work. And I just wish it wasn't like that. I don't think there's an answer for that, because it's the system, not the people. But like, you have to be able to have balance in your life, I think, to be happy. And it makes you better at your job when you can take moments of joy and you can see it objectively from the outside, and you're not just effectively a machine for a corporation. You're a full living person. You're a plant, you know, you've got to water yourself and get some sun and take some time.
Yeah. Well, what does Geordie do for work, Gina?
He's a electronic engineer. I think, no, he's an electrical engineer. I always say electronic, and he's like, electronics and electricals are different things. And I'm like, yes, they are. He's an electrical engineer, and he works on the boats, on the Thames, like the boats that take people up and down the Thames, the Uber boats.
Oh,
so he keeps
right.
them all running. He works yeah. nights. He works days. I've never met anyone who works so hard. We have such different lives. My job is very much a thinking job. There's a lot of writing, there's a lot of facilitating discussions, there's a lot of organizing, and Geordie's job is so physical and, you know, 14 hours through the night covered wow. in oil, like on the river, like he's just, yeah. And we both, I think for a long time, I'd be like, my brain's so tired. He'd be like, my body's so tired. And now we really like respect and understand each other's work in a really healthy way, which is lovely.
How has he found living in the UK, coming from Australia?
Hard.
Especially London as well. Poor guy. You brought him straight into London, Gina.
Honestly, like because we met when I was had just left. We met in my third year of uni, and I was like, well, I have to go to London because that's where the ad jobs are. And I don't have any, well, I didn't have any connections in London. I didn't know anyone. I didn't, you know, I don't come from a family where principally they would just give me money, but also they don't, you know, they don't have money lying around. We don't have intergenerational wealth. We don't have inherited wealth. It's just like, I went to London and, you know, you work two jobs in uni, so go to London and make it work. And we'll be here, but make it work. And so I was kind of sofa surfing for sort of 6 months and interning for free. And then I lived in the storeroom of a pub. This like old guy called Jerry just was like, do you want to live here? And me and my friend were like, we'll probably die, but yes, because we have nowhere to live and we need this job. So we ended up living in this storeroom of a pub. And to this day, he actually became like my dad. He's like the most amazing person ever. I stayed there for 2 years, and my friend who lived with me, who was my creative partner at the agency, lived there for like 6 years. She only moved out a couple of years ago. So obviously Geordie was like in London with this girl who doesn't have any roots at all. He didn't have any roots, and we were both just floundering for years. He would work like landscaping jobs and like anything he could get, and like, you know, building jobs and maintenance jobs, and he, you know, getting a room in a share flat for like £600 a month, and he couldn't afford it. And I was eating rice every night, and it was just like wild those first few years. But we loved each other. Like, and we're just best mates. And it was like, he really did make a decision to come here for me so that I could build a career and so that we could be together. And there was a lot of guilt about that in the first 2 years from my side. Just go home. Like, you have an amazing family, little sisters who are four. You don't see them. You can't pay to get home. Like, just go home. This isn't fair for you to be here. And he was like, but I'm making the choice to be here. Like, I want to be here. And funny things, like he'd get on the tube and he'd just be like, I have to get out of here. Like, there's two, why is there so many people? Like, I just can't stand, like, there's four traffic lights in my town. Why is there so many people here? I cannot stand this place. But really now he's, you know, after 6 years of being here, he's established himself and he's got a job that he, you know, is passionate about. He loves electrical, especially electronics, but he loves electrical engineering, and he's made friends, and he feels like he's found his place in London now. But I think for a lot of years, it was like, this is a different place to where I'm from, and I'm struggling to be here.
And when Geordie moved to the UK, at that time, were you going, is that when your phase of getting abuse, online abuse from men started, or did this happen a bit later down the line?
That was much later. So he moved 2013. I worked in advertising for about 4 years. And within that time, we went to live in Greece to work on boats for a bit, because Geordie was working on boats as a mechanic for a while in Greece. And then I didn't start the campaign until 2017. So 2017 was when all the abuse started, and when I started to get a platform because of the upskilling campaign I was doing. And so I effectively went from someone who works in an office on like 24 grand a year, like trying to get by in a very expensive city, to someone who was like doing that exact thing, but while running a campaign with the government, or not with the government, against the government, and a media campaign, and getting a platform and dealing with all this abuse. And it was really hard. And Geordie actually was working in the North Sea for a while on boats as an engineer for that period of time. So he would be away for like 6 weeks at a time with no cell reception, no phone, like 200 miles out to sea, maintaining wind farms. So he couldn't even contact me. So that was really hard. But then in 2018, he got that job in London that he's in now. So we were able to be together, and he's just been, I don't know, like just such a wild support system through this, the whole campaigning and activism journey. Like, I can't express how incredible he is. Like, from, you know, stupid stuff like making little signs to pop on the mirror because I forget to charge my toothbrush, to like, you know, I'd come home from Parliament when Chope objected to a bill that we'd put through, and I'd done like 41 interviews and I was just emotionally a wreck, and I'd come home and he would have like made like a massive dinner and like got all my jammies out and like put me in the bath, and he would like put a film on and he'd like wrap me up, and he's just such a nurturing person, which was such a wonderful thing to have when you were going through so much stress like that.
What was it like with your parents, Gina? Were they worried about you? Because putting yourself out there, I mean, even just like going on Good Morning Britain, right? It's a channel where you can get so much abuse. I remember when I went on, I was completely oblivious to all this. It was my naivety where I just said, look, I just want to create a change. But so much comes with that. Like, you get all the abuse, you get all these people saying, go back to your country, especially for me, just looking at my skin color immediately and saying, you don't belong here. But the funny thing was that when I did Good Morning Britain, I didn't actually realize, but just before me, Matt Hancock was on. So for a moment, we were on a split screen. And he's a guy I've been waiting to talk to this whole time. And I had a chance, but obviously I didn't know because of the way the production was working. But after that Good Morning Britain interview that I did, I realized how brutal people can really be. You can try and create the most positive change in the world. You can cure cancer, Gina, and I still think people will come after you. But what was it like for you at that time? And what did your parents say to you when you said, look, this is what I'm going to do and I need your support?
What were they like? There wasn't a moment where I said that. I mean, I just started doing this thing and they saw it grow as I did it. And they got probably more nervous as it went on. But my parents have always been really good at allowing me to make decisions and take risks. And they have enough, I think they have a good amount of respect for me and my sister, and belief in us that we make the right decisions and we take care of ourselves and we will do the right things. But I also think, you know, thinking about gender in terms of being a parent, I also think that something I love about my parents, or something I love about my father in particular, is that he doesn't have this like overprotective father-daughter thing that I think I would have struggled with. There isn't this, I need to keep my daughters wrapped in cotton wool. When I was a teenager, there was never like, oh, you're dating? You're not dating? Or like anything like that. My parents see me for my humanity, not my agenda. And they allow me to make mistakes and take risks and do what I need to do because they know that it's important to me. And I've done a bunch of stuff, you know, in the past 5 years that they've been, we want you to do this, it's important to you, but we are nervous. Of course we're nervous, but that doesn't really matter. How we feel doesn't really matter. It's just how you feel and what you want to do. So they were kind of nothing but supportive. And also just a space for me to go to with complexity of feelings that maybe other people wouldn't have understood. Like, I need to do this and I hate it and I hate doing it and I'm terrified, but I'm also really proud, but I'm also this and I can't figure it out. And they would just let me unpick and talk about that for hours. You know, that's the kind of people, that's the kind of parents they are in relationship we have. So they were phenomenal. And, you know, I don't know necessarily that I would have got through the campaign and come out the other end as well as I have, although, you know, I'm in therapy for it because it was wild. But I don't think I would have got through it without having people around me who just held me through it and didn't try and make me do anything a certain way.
Gina, I have a question to ask you, and I'm only asking you because I know how sort of open you are and well-read you are on lots of different topics and you're willing to learn. And I ask you this question because I know that you've been through a lot of trauma, a lot of emotional distress throughout this time. But if you look at, for example, I mean, there are thousands of Gina Martins in the world who wanted to do the same thing. Not necessarily just in the UK, but maybe in different parts of the world. And I think one of the advantages we do have generally as a population here is that freedom of speech is kind of sort of existent here, that we can speak up. And luckily now we are safe to protest and, you know, we won't get condemned for that. But I also feel that the color of our skin matters and the culture we come from matters as well. So if we're talking about a campaign or trying to create change or trying to create a movement, you know, you might not be running the same 100 meters as someone from a different ethnic background or someone from who's got a different, you know, view on life or comes from a different country. They're carrying more baggage. And, you know, when I went through my protesting, I had a lot of additional stress. I was carrying the load of my family because they didn't want me to do it. They were saying that, you know, someone's going to get rid of your passport or someone's going to, you know, you're going to lose your medical license. And these were the things there. But I had to, I mean, to the extent that, Gina, that there are still some family members who completely cut me off and they haven't spoken to me in 2 years and I probably never hear from them again because of what I did. But I created the change I wanted to change, but I had that extra emotional distress. Now, as someone who's been through that same process, how do you think, as someone in your position, can help people who don't maybe have it just as easy? I wouldn't say easy because easy is not the right word, but maybe have to carry more things along with them to create the same movement or to have the same impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important part of the conversation, right? Like I've always said, the campaign, it was like, I'm not arrogant enough to believe that the reason, like even the campaign, the reason why it happened was all because of whatever I did. I think there was a lot of reasons why people responded to me in certain ways. There was a lot of reasons why newspapers put me on the front of their magazines in certain ways. The, you know, the assumption of innocence that I have as a white woman that makes people go, oh, look at this lovely feminine young white woman who's got something to say. No way. Like, wow. And that's welcomed because of who I am. And I think if I wasn't who I am, or I didn't speak the way I do, or I looked different, if I was someone different in the world in Britain, I don't think that the words that surrounded the pictures of me in magazines would have been the same words. And I don't think the narrative around me would have been the same. And I think that would have come with a whole other set of challenges that obviously I didn't experience, both personally and, you know, perceptively from the public. I think the job or the opportunity that I have in recognizing that allows me to give my skills to other people. So when I think about the Upskirting campaign, I think about Ryan Whelan, my lawyer, who was a privileged white man who was a lawyer. And he could say, okay, I'm going to represent you and I'm going to do it pro bono. And he pushed and pushed. And he took a chance on me and he did that. And he amplified my voice. And he was, the way in which we worked together was what I always imagined allyship, quote unquote, whatever that word now means, would be like. And so when the campaign ended, I had a kind of opportunity to do the same thing for other people because I'd built up a whole load of skills and could I give those to someone else? And so when a good example of that is, you know, 2021, I think it was, Or might have been 2020 now. No. Maybe it was 2020. Oh my God. Naomi Nicholas Williams is a model. She was having all her pictures taken down from Instagram, and she's being censored by Instagram continuously. The pictures were like amazing photographs taken by Alex Cameron. They were sort of her sitting on a stool holding a bush of lavender across her breast, and she had like shorts on, and it was just like stunning. And they were taken down because she was partly nude and because she was a plus-size black woman, because the Playboy Instagram account is full frontal nudity but all of thin white women, and we're very used to seeing that in the male gaze. We're used to consuming those type of bodies, but we are less used to and less comfortable because of fat phobia and into, you know, racism and misogynoir, of seeing bigger black bodies and seeing them as they can, you know, have autonomy over them and they're not for me. And so I remember, like, in that moment I was like, she told me, Alex told me, that Naomi's pictures were being taken down. And I was like, oh, okay, this is an opportunity for me to, like, give my skills over to someone. Like, she wants to run a campaign, but she hasn't done it before. She's going to be dealing with everything I dealt with. And on top of what I dealt with, she's going to be dealing with racism. And on top of that, she's going to be dealing with fat phobia. And she's going to get so much more abuse, and she's going to be navigating so many more systems to try and get this done. So it was like, okay, let me come up with ideas and a bit of a strategy and a plan for her, with her, about how we can get, you know, Instagram to listen, how we can change the policy. And we worked on that for like 6 months. And that was behind the scenes. You know, that wasn't my campaign. That was me working for her. That's an example, I think, of how I like to do this work now. Like, I don't ever really want to do a campaign about like I did with the upskirting thing. I don't want to be the face of it. I don't, mainly because it's emotional turmoil, but also because I think it's very impossible for me to do a campaign and not be a girl boss, not be like, I can't control the narrative. I would do interviews and talk about, you know, something. I did an interview where I talked about how hard it was to have a full-time job and campaign at the same time and not have the money to pump into the campaign, all this kind of stuff. And that was kind of rewritten as like, you can have it all because she does it. So like everything was kind of repurposed to be like that kind of girl boss. Look at this white, young, fashionable girl in the suit. Like, go take on the patriarchy. Like, that's not what it's like. Like, that's not what we're doing. But there's a very commodified, commercialized version of feminism, and I am perfect for that. If you want, like, I'm the easy, like, the news and the media love me for that, because I'm the young white woman who wears colourful clothing, and I'm quite, you know, I'm northern, I'm quite bouncy, and instantly I become a girl boss in the media. So I'm very uncomfortable with that positioning of me. I think that positioning is quite damaging to the movement generally. I don't think we need more of those. I don't think we need more of me representing the movement, to be honest. So it's nice to be able to do organising that's less exposing. And I think the way that I can help is to, like, give my space over to other people, give my skills over to other people alongside the other stuff I do. I just feel like, and I like doing it that way. I like working with people. That's what activism is. You're organizing with people.
Well, you're doing that now, Gina. I think even doing this podcast in itself is sharing your story to people in itself is can help so many other people start their own campaigns or just learn from your story. So I think it's the small things that you do that you might not realize has an impact, but really does. Even the things you post on Instagram or the things you post on Twitter, trying to educate people. I think it really does start from things as small as that to be part of a bigger movement and a bigger change.
Yeah, and I think there's a role for everyone. I think making it seem exclusive or making it seem cool or making it seem whatever, insert word here, to do this work or be a campaigner or be an advocate or an activist, I think that goes against what we're trying to do. I think we need as many people as possible. And I feel like when you've achieved something or you've done something, laying your cards on the table and giving them over to people is how we, like, we share tools, right? Like, that's how we get to where we want to get to.
Gina, I spoke to Catherine Mayer a couple of weeks ago. She also went through something similar where she experienced sexism and ageism at a time where she was working Time magazine. And she told me that the emotional turmoil and the distress that she went through actually manifested into physical symptoms. She could feel it. She felt the anxiety go through her body. And I'll be very honest, like, I went through a difficult time as well, but I don't really remember much because I was also pregnant. So I don't know if there were pregnancy symptoms or just like stress symptoms. Oh. I was going through so many different things and we were in a pandemic. So I don't actually really remember. It might take me some time to sort of figure out what really happened. But Can you just talk me through what it was really like for you, Gina? Like, you know, what was it like going to bed at night? What was it like waking up in the morning to an inbox on your Twitter or your Instagram full of messages, or an email, your email inbox just wanting, you know, journalists wanting to speak to you? What was it like?
What's the word for it? Very overwhelming. I think the constant mix of emotions, because you have to play so many roles when you do something like that. I'm going to work every day and I'm a copywriter at my office. I'm trying to be a good partner to my partner. I'm trying to still be a friend and still be available to my friends when I'm completely stretched thin. I'm a campaigner. And when I'm in front of the news cameras, they want emotion out of me and they want me to cry about what happened. And when I'm in politics, I can't show any emotion because I have to assimilate to all the men in the room who literally communicate in one way. And then I'm with survivors and I'm collecting stories and I'm talking to kids. So I'm then like an older person who can lead them through and make them feel more validated about the fact that they were upskirted and it wasn't their fault. And then I'm this. And then, so it's that, like, you're just every day, you're code switching all the time to what is needed to make this thing happen, which you have no guarantee is going to happen, right? Like, you don't do it because you're like, oh, I'll be able to make it. Like, I quite honestly didn't believe for maybe the first year and a half that I was going to change the law. It's just I couldn't not do it because there was thousands of people willing to do it who needed the help because they'd fallen victim to upskirting. And there's just a sense of momentum and a sense of your nervous system, I feel like, is just on high alert all the time. Like, you can't relax. I used to dream about the campaign and then I'd wake up at 5 a.m. and work on it and then go to work. And then I'd come back from work at 6 and then I'd go to the law firm until 11 and then I'd go to sleep and dream about it. And then I'd work. And I don't know necessarily. And with social media, you add social media into that and everything is amplified. You get way more messages, you get way more asks, you get way more requests, you get way more stories of sexual violence you're reading from other people that you're taking in. Everything is faster and more. So it was incredibly overwhelming, but I had internalized the idea of being the perfect victim of sexual violence. Like, I was like, oh, I got upskirted, but look at me. I can handle it. I can talk about it. I'm not crying every time I talk about it. I'm strong, which means we can be strong. And I'd really internalized that, and that I had to lead by example and all that kind of stuff, that I didn't let myself feel any of it the whole time I was doing it. And if you'd asked me when I was doing it, I would have said, oh, I feel it all the time because I'm crying all the time because I'm stressed. But I hadn't really processed it. I think I was probably maybe a little bit difficult to be around during that period of time, but not because I was unfair or angry or, well, I was actually very angry the entire time, but mostly with the government and with, like, the world, not with my friends and family, but mainly just because I didn't have time. I couldn't process anything. I would cry about everything. I decided to go to therapy because every time I would talk to my parents or my sister, whatever we were talking about would lead to me crying about something and then me offloading about something I'm struggling with or my fear or these guys who don't like me and what if they turn up and all this stuff. And I started to realize, like, they're not your therapists. Like, this isn't a space. You have to have your own space where you can every week you've got an hour to unpack everything and you know it's there. So you'll start to not save it up, not knowing where it's going to go, but just save it up for Thursday, you know? And that's really helped me, but I didn't have that during the campaign. And I think if I had, I would have been a lot better, a lot less damaging to myself during it, because it was definitely overwhelming. It's very scary. And it was, I was also learning about politics and law, didn't know anything about it. I was just like learning how to do it while I was doing it and felt like an idiot. And politicians would make me feel like a dickhead. And oh my God, it was so hard. So I think my learning would be, if I was going to go back to 2017, I would be like, right, get a therapist before you start. And also delegate better. Like, I didn't need to do everything I did. I felt like I had to control absolutely everything and I didn't.
How have you felt since you changed the law? And then I believe that was probably the transition into the pandemic. Is that right? Or?
Yeah. So that was April 2019. So I had about almost a year until the pandemic after it, where I did like loads of educating around the law. But I definitely, the pandemic forced me to stop And what that forced me to do was be able to actually reflect on my work and what I wanted to do and how I'd talked during that campaign. And did I want to work with these institutions or did I want to work on the ground? And all these questions and all this processing happened that I was unable to do because I was moving too fast when I was in it. And that's been a godsend, I think, because I'm a lot more considered and I learn slower. And I'm not as reactive and I don't feel the need to prove everything I know all the time quickly. And I don't feel at the behest of thousands of people anymore. But for a little while I did.
Hmm. And when you were doing your campaign and then you changed the law and you achieved everything that you were working so hard for, did you continue working in your job or did you leave it at that time and just focus on educating people?
I assumed I'd go back to work, which I think was a silly assumption, a naive assumption maybe. And then it became very obvious that my job was becoming untenable because there was the amount of attention around me when the law changed. It was like my boss was saying, well, yeah, you have to go and do all these interviews and talk about this law. You've changed the law and you have to educate on it. But like, we also, you work here and you're not here anymore. And like, what are we going to do? So I had to leave. And I got given the opportunity to put a load of tools and a load of strategies and a load of ideas I'd had into a book. And so I thought, okay, well, I can write this book and make a little bit of money, which can tide me over until I can figure out what to do. And that just turned into a very, ad hoc way of living now, which is that my job is that I'm a writer and I am like a consultant and I'm a, you know, an influencer and that, but I always think my job is my activism, but it's not because I get paid for it, but it's the thing that from when I wake up to I go to bed, that's all I think about and all I do, it's all for that. But yeah, I had to leave my job. It's funny that I thought I could just go back. It's like, why did you think that? Mm. But I did for some reason.
Because even now, Gina, when people ask me about my life moving forward after we, because, well, I never really say it out loud this way, but we essentially also changed the law when it came to PPE and the policies, especially to protect ethnic minority groups better. Once we changed the law, a few months after that, it was almost time for me to go back into work. And a part of me was just like, yeah, just go in back into my training program, just be a GP. And it's only a few months ago where I had to sit down with my husband and said, I just don't think I can go back to that life because it changes you so much. And you start to understand how on a personal level and on a, you know, public level and a global level, you can have an impact through your laptop, like through that little tiny box. There's so much that you can actually do. But what happened to me at that time was obviously because I was on maternity leave, I was trying to figure out, okay, how do I make money now? And I think one of the things that I realized to truly be an activist or just a campaigner, if that's just your job title, that you just do campaigns, you have to have some sort of privilege because you don't have to worry about rent or your electricity bills or anything like that. So just like you, you have to figure out other ways to bring in the money. And that could mean having lots of different job titles. But at the same time, I felt that because I wanted to go into that avenue, I almost felt like I had to know everything about everything, which is also the case after the pandemic because we've seen so much happen around the world. So how do you sort of keep yourself in check and say to yourself, okay, Gina, this is something I need to speak up about. This is something I'm very aware of and I should share my knowledge, or this is something I should just sort of keep quiet on and read up on and then just keep it to myself.
I have a couple of like general rules and that like things that I try to keep myself accountable to that are, I have a lane and I try and stay in my lane. So in terms of the role of someone who knows about things and can like educate, for want of a better word, people on stuff, that's like gender equality. And I'm intersectional about that because I only really learn from writers. And I mean, I didn't learn anything about gender from, to be quite honest, from white women and white men, really. I learned through intersectionality, through being with people, being mentored by people, reading books, watching, you know, being involved in conversations, all those kind of things for years. So that kind of, I find that when I'm thinking about gender and gender inequality, it comes naturally for me to think intersectionally because that's how I learned it. But then outside, and I'm very specific about what my part of that is. I don't educate on gender inequality. I educate effectively on rape culture, really, because I talk about sexual assault and I talk about sexual violence. I talk about male violence. I talk about how gender feeds into that. And then on everything else, it's like, because there's an expectation, especially if you exist on social media with a platform, there's an expectation that you must know everything if you know quite a lot about one social issue. And I think there's also, because I'm a white woman, I think a lot of people, maybe from, well, definitely from my community, feel I'm palatable and they feel safe when I say stuff because, well, firstly, the bar is really low for me to talk on anything. So when I do, they're like, oh my God, no way you talked about that. Like when a guy talks about feminism, we're like, wow. And you're like, the bar's so low. Like he said the most basic shit. But like, that's what I, me too, with every other issue, because I'm a white woman. It's like, Jeannie, you're a queen. I'm like, no, I'm not. Like everyone, go and look at all these people that I've learned from and saying this for like years. But I also think like people feel like young white women who follow me are like, oh, Gina knows, she's a young white woman, so I'll listen to her. And it's like, I've learned all that stuff from other people. So my general rule is I stay in my lane with like gender equality and rape culture stuff. Yes, I'm happy to educate on that. And maybe some like musings on whiteness, as in my existence of whiteness. But apart from that, I kind of just try to share other people's stuff. And I just kind of try and signpost mostly. So, you know, if I'm working on a project and there's multiple subjects, I'll speak on the subjects that I know and work in, and then I'll get other people to speak on the ones that, like, I don't need to prove that I know that stuff because I learned it from other people. And I just don't, I also don't think there's anything I could, I don't think that I could articulate anything on, like, race, class, LGBTQIA plus rights, blah, blah, blah. There's nothing, or disability, there's nothing that I could articulate on that would be articulated to the degree that someone else could. Do you know what I mean? Who's, like, lived it, experienced it, works in it. So the general rule is like, stick to my lane, be an educator on that stuff, stuff I've experienced, the stuff I know, and then signpost other people, which is why I repost mostly. My stories are mostly reposts, and also why when I work on bigger projects, there's always other people. I facilitate more than I try, you know, take over. Mm. I just don't really have an interest in doing that.
Gina, there was just one thing that came to mind. Yesterday, I came across one of your Instagram posts. You can call it stalking, you can call it research, whatever. when you changed the law in 2019, just to clarify, what is a law now? So when someone takes a photo, is it instant jail time, and for how long? What's the actual law?
Yeah, so it's really good to clarify, actually, because I think, as you know, the media, everything around the law change is sensationalized. Apart from the fact that they kept saying it was a new law, which it absolutely wasn't. It was just a word change in Section 67 of the Sexual Offences Act 2003. So we changed the law as it stood, but we didn't introduce a new law. What we did is, before the Voyeurism Act, which we introduced, if you were upskirted by someone, it would be difficult to prosecute every instance of that happening. So the reason for that was because we only really had things we could use, like old common laws, which are like 100-year-old laws, like outraging public decency, which was the most commonly used law for upskirting, although the language of upskirting didn't exist in prosecutions because it wasn't in law. That law says that something has happened to someone and the public have had to witness it, and the public are outraged of having to witness it. So for instance, if I went to a festival and weed in a field, I could be charged with outraging public decency because it's like, it's vile, crude, people have to see it and they don't like it. When you apply that to something like upskirting, what that says is that someone has been upskirted and the victims of that scenario are the public who had to watch it, but absolutely fails to recognise that there's any victim or survivor in the mix. Also fails to recognise that it's a sexual offence, that it's part of the spectrum of sexual violence at all. So they were kind of trying to fit a common law on a sexual offence. It wasn't really working. Part of that reason is because outrage and public decency, there's a list of tick boxes you have to satisfy to be able to prosecute. Like a certain amount of people saw it. And you also didn't get benefits of, depending on the situation, of a sexual offence, specific offence. So things like you can be anonymous when you report it or if you go through the system. So when it happened to me and I handed it over to the police and they said, oh, there's not much we can do, it's not because they literally couldn't. It's just because prosecuting it in a specific place like that in public is quite hard, because the only other law you can use is the Voyeurism Act. That's my act. The only other law you could use is voyeurism. So like when you're in a toilet or you're in a changing room, I have a reasonable expectation of privacy so no one can take a picture of my crotch. But when I'm in a festival, that doesn't exist anymore because I've taken my body out into a public place. So you start to see how complex it is and how there's a loophole in the law and the law isn't working for this act because the law hasn't caught up with technology. So we proposed, which Scotland had done for 10 years before we changed the law, but England and Wales hadn't, to amend Section 67 of the Sexual Offences Act to make it a specific offence. So upskirting was an act that now existed in law, and it was treated similar to how the rest of the Sexual Offence Act was. So it didn't matter where you were in it, whether you were in a public place or a private place. All these satisfactions that you had to tick no longer mattered. It just recognised that that was a sexual offence, and that any part of your body that you'd covered by clothing was a private place because you'd chosen to cover it. And when someone crossed the line to violate that, that was a sexual offence. So now what it means is, if you're upskirted, obviously, depending on every case, CPS, take into account all different types of things. If they've found that that person has done it multiple times, there will be a more severe punishment. But it ranges from everything to like fines all the way to jail time. Now, the media love to talk about the jail time because a headline that says, you know, upskirting will become a sexual offence and the punishments will range from this to this isn't very cool to click on. But if you say people are going to be put in jail for upskirting, everyone clicks on it because they go, jailed? Upskirting? Whoa. The reality is that very few people are jailed for upskirting. The men who have been jailed for upskirting with this law since were convicted paedophiles, one of which who had 250,000 indecent images of children on his phone. And what they found, and they being the CPS, have found that a third of people who, it's all majority men, sadly, who perpetrate upskirting are perpetrating violent, repeat sexual violence alongside it. So we're seeing it often as a gateway behaviour, but we're also seeing it as something they're doing while they're perpetrating other horrendous crimes that are ongoing and historical and have been happening for years. So that's when you might get jail time. But, you know, as you know, Good Morning Britain. I went on Good Morning Britain and the conversation was like, we don't want to put 16-year-olds in jail for upskirting. And I'm like, no one's doing that. Like, it's wild. So that's the law now. So it is a sexual offence. The police should take it seriously, but we could have a 4-hour discussion on how the CPS, the police and our, I don't even want to say justice system, are failing survivors and victims. So that's a whole nother story. And that's the reason why I don't do... I won't do a campaign like that again, because I'd rather work with people to prevent it than criminalise it after it's happened now. Mm. But that is the change. It's now a sexual offence. You can report it and it will be treated as such. And anything from fines to jail time if they find that they're a repeat violent offender who is perpetrating other sexual crimes.
Gina, what do you think about the word and the term punishment? Because, you know, when you look at other systems in different parts of the world, people treat different criminal acts with, I would say, a bit more empathy, and there's more. It's more about educating them. For example, like I know in Norway, prisons are completely different. They're not as harsh as they are here, and as we see in the US. I'm not entirely sure how it works here, but I know, like in the US, it's all about money. The systems work with the government, and they're just trying.
It's very similar here, yeah.
You know, trying to make a business out of it. But as someone who's been through the process of not just being a victim to it, but also trying to change the law and understanding how things works and getting a glimpse into this world, what do you think the right way is? Do you think that punishing people can create a change? Do you think we should focus our energy on those people not doing it again, or focusing on the rest of the public to not do it at all, if that makes sense?
It does. I think, well, I wrote about this for Shadow Magazine recently. I don't think there's an answer. I don't think it's an or. I think there's lots of ands. What I do know now, sitting here at 30 years old, which I didn't know at 25, when the biggest thing I could possibly imagine was that you could change the law, and I didn't even have the imagination at that point, or the framework of abolition, all those kinds of other movements, to understand that there's something past that, that we can imagine structures and ideas in society that don't exist yet, that didn't exist in my head then. Which obviously, if it did, I probably wouldn't have gone and criminalised something. Now, I believe that, I mean, you're right as well about the prison system in Britain. Like, I think I'm right in saying we have one of the most profitable prison systems in Europe. I think that's correct. It is a capitalist endeavour. I don't think it's built on humanity. We know something like upwards of 95% of offenders reoffend when they come out of our prisons in terms of sexual violence. So it's not working. No one's rehabilitating anyone. I do believe that you can rehabilitate people. I believe that. And that is something that in 2020 and 2021, I wrestled with because I started to learn about abolition. A friend of mine who's an activist pulled me up on it and said, the way that you talked during the campaign was in direct opposition to abolition movements. And it was, because when you're working with the government to change a law, you can't speak like that. And I didn't know those theories and those ideologies yet. And so, you know, I'd say, yes, report to the police. And yeah, the CPS are working really hard on trying to change Islam. You know, and it was very pro the institution I was working with, because I had to, because I was trying to change the law. And because I was ignorant at that point to this specific thing. Now that I've wrestled with that for a couple of years, I believe that the systems are failing us, but more so that they were created to fail, because they weren't created with people in mind, with people's full humanity, the idea of being able to rehabilitate people, to reintegrate people into society in a humane way where they get something out of that rehabilitation. They are able to live a fuller, healthier, happier life after something punitive. And I also think that if the main narrative that you set for sexual violence is punitive, so you do this, you will be punished by the state, by me, by everyone, I think that creates an instant or default position of defensivism. So I see it in conversations with men around gender, in the interpersonal, where when I go into schools, boys are not engaged because they've already been told they are the problem before I even get in the room. And they don't think there's anything in the conversation for them. They don't think feminism or gender equality or any of those things will give them anything. They think it's all about women. And this like lack of understanding, this oversimplification of what it is. I see them get defensive and shut off because they think they're going to be punished for saying the wrong thing. And I don't think we get anywhere with that. So that's why now after wrestling with all that, those kind of feelings, and I can't, you know, erase my old work, and questions then become, would I want to? Because do I want these, you know, very violent offenders who were paedophiles to be on the street? Well, no, but I also don't want the prison system to exist. And then you have to unpack all that, and it's incredibly difficult. But now I'm at a place personally where all I know is that I want to work in prevention going forward, because I would much rather create environments where people can critically engage with gender and opt out of ideas about how they should act, stereotypes, biases they have about people, before they get to the point that those things start to turn either coercive, abusive, or violent. So I think prevention is where I sit now, and I think punitive is not where I sit now. But I also can't erase my old work. And then I also, while I was going through this, I had a stalker for 2 years, an online stalker from school who just was a nightmare. It actually went on for 8 years, all in all, on and off, but for 2 years it was really bad. And he got sentenced in December because some of his victims fought for him to be sentenced. Some of his survivors, I should say. And, you know, then I had this, like, evening where I sat there, like, I don't want the prison system to exist, but I want Matt Hardy to be in jail because he's a direct threat to me. And so those two things can be true at the same time. And I'm just going to what's my role? Prevention. Okay, that's what I'm going to do for the next 35 years. Like, that's all I can control, you know? So that's kind of where I sit now. But as you can tell by the way I'm talking through the thoughts, I'm still figuring all that out.
I love that, Gina. I love how you're being very honest with your thoughts. And I guess we all think out loud, and sometimes we don't know all the answers. And I think that's really important as well, whether... when you have such a big platform, everyone thinks you have all the answers. It's very good of you to say, look, I don't have all the answers, but these are my thoughts. And, you know, sometimes we have to say that because people do eventually put you on a pedestal. And then actually that then will just take you back to all of that emotional stress and you know, difficulties that you faced when you were going through your campaign. Now, we've been through the pandemic and we've seen everything that we could possibly see in the world, I think, in the last 2 years. I mean, people haven't seen in a lifetime. Now we're seeing Russia and Ukraine, and there's too much going on for us to all digest to some degree, but there's a lot of things that we can learn. How have you come out of this pandemic? Do you feel more hopeful for the future? Do you feel that people are more willing to learn Do you feel like everything that's happened probably happened all at the right time because now people are more perceptive?
Do you know what? I don't know. And having just had the chat about not having the answers, I think because we're still in it, I still can't see how I feel about it. The only things I know about the pandemic and my only like gut feelings are that I have absolutely no faith in the government. I think they are violent and I think they have failed everyone. And I'm so angry about the way they've handled it. Everything from micro communications to the way that they've, the self-interest in contracts to, you know, I lost my grandma because Matt Hancock was sending people back to care homes without getting tested. Like, I feel like if we take the truth that their job is to keep people safe, I don't know if that is even the truth, is it? Or is it just like a hierarchy thing? But I think they failed at that massively and I hate them. big time. I also thought I would come out at the beginning. I think I would have assumed that by the end of it, we would have seen people change their big, you know, a sea change of ideas about how we live. And I'm losing hope that we've got that because although I've seen so much good and compassion come out of this pandemic, because when we go through, when we suffer, we see people really help and we see wonderful things. And I've seen so much of that. And I see that every day in my job. That's why I like my job. But I also just don't know that the people who have enough power to create those changes care. And I feel very disillusioned after the pandemic and I feel very sad. There's one thing that I do think that could be seen as a positive is that the problems we always had that were always there have been exposed more so. And we can't necessarily look, I mean, a lot of people will, but I don't believe it would be easy to look away from them as much as it was in 2018. So I'm hoping that when the dust settles, we try and create something better because I don't want to go back to what we had before. But I definitely don't have any belief in powerful people that lead our country that will do that. I think it's going to be all the wonderful people that I work with, people like you, organisers, advocates, educators, who do that, who are left with that burden because the people who should be protecting us aren't.
Mm. I think there's always that worry for me as well, Gina, that all of these grassroots organizations and systems that are running, a lot of them are running on goodwill because they don't really gain anything personal from it. And there's always that fear that how long will that goodwill last, especially when we're working against a system that doesn't seem to work in our favor at all and doesn't have our interest. When we're talking about public issues, it's only the interest of the politicians and their friends around them. So that's my only worry, is that how long can we run on goodwill as a society and as a global community?
Do you know what? That's a really good point. I feel like people always ask me about, like, how did you keep going in the campaign? I don't know, like, whenever I do a panel or whatever. And I always say to them, like, it wasn't charity. Like, I was angry. Like, I lived it, so I couldn't stop because I was so angry. Like, if you look around and try and pick stuff to change, you'll never continue because it doesn't come from your belly. It's not your story. It's not your life. But if it's your life and it's your existence, it's very difficult to stop. But then equal to that, on the other side of that coin, is that I don't want people to have to fight for all those things all the time. I want peace for people. I want people to be able to experience joy. I don't want to glamorize pain and suffering. Like, oh, it's so amazing. Like, no, actually, you shouldn't have to do that. But until we get to a point where there's enough people in power who are doing this for humanity and the good of people and understand what it's like to live in the real world, not the cabinet we have now, I think it's going to be up to us to put our anger and pain into interaction, emotion and move. And the truth, the good part of that is that it works. Like, we never think about the fact that we literally have a weekend because of unions fighting. Like, you think of the weekend like you think of time. Like, it's just there. It was there, wasn't it? No, of course not. Like, they literally created the weekend. Like, all the things that you have that you wouldn't even be able to name came from normal people fighting for things. So often it can feel like we don't make as much of an impact, but that's why I didn't go into politics when 50 people were telling me to stand, because it's like, but we can make just as much change outside of politics as they can. I think more. I think that's why they have to put all these bills through to controllers, because they're scared. They're trying to stop us protesting. They're trying to stop us being able to vote without having photo ID. They're squeezing the walls of our freedoms because there's so many of us. And if they, you know, if they didn't do that, like, we would be protesting every day. We would be trying to change stuff every day. Like, we would be fighting every day. So I think, you know, it works. And it can't be on goodwill, I don't think, because that lasts too long. It has to be on solidarity. It has to be on real fire in the belly, and it has to be on passion. And if it's on passion and anger, which is a good thing, I think we'll get there together, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Gina. I had such a lovely chat, and it was nice to know everything about you before you changed the law as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in again this week. And thank you to Gina for sharing everything that you've learned over the last few years and all of your knowledge and being so honest as well. I really enjoyed that chat. Can't wait to see you all next Friday with another guest, and I better get going because Radhika seems like she wants a cuddle. I've left all of the links for you to follow Gina in the show notes below, and I've also left the link for you to order her book as well. I'll see you all next week. Take care and have a lovely week.